My friends, I bring you good news. Climate change is not the great moral problem of our time. In 2007, when Kevin Rudd, who was then just the federal opposition leader, gave it that top billing, he was right to do so. And it was a story ripe for the narrative of Christian redemption. We needed a great moral awakening. Nothing less than the repentance of an entire species would do, and lots of us were up for it. We looked forward to a spreading of the light. We got Tony Abbott. But there are two narratives of redemption that wind through the stories of the people of God. One is the story of Paul the Pharisee, struck down, given new sight, and sent forth. Since then, it's a path trodden by few and sought by many. It's often regarded as kind of the gold standard for a moral awakening. The other narrative is much more common and less glamorous. It's 40 days or 40 years of hard scrabble in the wilderness. It's a Lenten journey. On that journey, we learn, we experiment, we mess up, and we emerge not necessarily triumphant, but at least ready. Our reading is a story of such a journey through the wilderness. We tend to focus on the miracle of the water, or on the failure of Moses' leadership, or on God's slightly qualified forgiveness. I want to think for a minute about our complaining wanderers. They had bought into a dream of future promise, but payday never arrives. They were learning to craft ideas of the good and the godly. They stumbled forward and they turned back. Occasionally, they seemed to completely lose faith in their national institutions. Does this sound familiar? Don't beat up on too much, but let's think about the journey that they've come on and that we've come on. What was the situation in 2007 when Kevin 07 called us to arms? What does that journey look like? On the surface, it doesn't look too good. The temperatures have continued to climb. The emission of fossil fuels that are at the root of the problem of climate change have continued to climb, although not quite as quickly as they were in 2007. Only two things have temporarily slowed them: the global financial crisis in 2008-2009 and COVID last year. Neither of those is a strategy that we'd like to pursue too often. I don't know about you, but last year wasn't my favourite way of reducing emissions. We've wasted a decade arguing that we could have spent working. We've run down our capital of fossil fuels that we can afford to spend to leave in the ground and still keep the climate below the 2 degrees that we think is a safe threshold. Some people have even started doing something rather like Moses' banging on rocks. In this case, they're trying to get our fossil fuel emissions back into the rocks they came from. It's not working as well as Moses' rod, by the way. And yet, I'm optimistic. What's with that? In 2007, every way we could think of out of this problem came at terrible human cost. Technology wouldn't do it. Most of the economic levers that we thought we could pull to do this risked stopping the alleviation of poverty that really has been one of the good stories of the last 30 years. It caused some of us to think about a revolution, But revolutions in the 20th century hadn't played out very well. Even their environmental records were pretty bad. We started to call climate change a wicked problem, and philosophers had a particular meaning about that. It wasn't just that it's a bad problem or a hard problem to solve, it's even a hard problem to think about. Every way that you think you go forward, you run into a wall. Despair was popular. The wise ones said, well, what can you expect of a species? We weren't really evolved for this kind of thing. In 2007, the cost of clean energy was so high that only the toughest or the most alarmed would follow it in large scale. We hoped that as we scaled up our production of these things, that the costs would come down, but every time we weighed the dream of a safe climate against the dream of future energy against the nightmare of climate change, we froze with indecision and blundered on. But reality exceeded the dream. The engineers kept at it. There was no magic. It was 5% here and 10% there. By now, it's 10 times cheaper to make clean energy in 2020 than it was in 2010. It's 5 times cheaper to store it. Australia leads the world in the installation of home rooftop solar panels. So we should. We've got lots of roofs and lots of sunshine. We're throwing away energy at the moment because we can't use it all. It's happening at the wrong time. That won't continue. It's easy money for someone. A range of solutions that are very difficult to think of until energy becomes just about free are now being seriously discussed. Clean ways to make steel, clean ways to make aluminium, clean ways to move energy around the world so that those that don't have resources of sun and wind like Australia can benefit from them. Australia is spectacularly placed to profit as a country and indeed to play its part in solving this problem. So if you wanted a revolution, this is not quite so hopeful. This is rather boring. Myself, I was concerned enough about climate change that what I wanted was a solution, and I can just about taste it from here. Even the politics has changed. The minimum you can do to stay on the right side of public opinion and indeed investor opinion has changed. All the people making investment decisions about what kind of infrastructure they should build and fund know that serious climate action is coming, independent of what the government is doing now. Pressure really works. The spirit of the times insinuates itself everywhere. By the way, we owe a tremendous debt to some very well-known names and millions of names we will never know who kept pushing and pushing and pushing that lever, tilting us towards action, making doing nothing a harder and harder option. So, I can sit down. We can kick back. We're done. I'm afraid not. Two reasons. The first is we've already locked in quite a bit of climate change. It's happened already. The 2019-2020 fires will tell us that. There's a lot more to come, and there's not much we can do about that. These are past mistakes. It's going to have victims, human and non-human, and we need to care for them. Some people try and trap us into a choice between caring for the world now and protecting the future. It's a false choice, and we can and should rise above it. The other problem is time. That wasted decade I talked about. A whole range of options that we had 10 years ago to help are no longer useful. They would have been controversial anyway, but they were at least options on the table. Options like gas or nuclear power, even. Options that may have helped with the climate change narrative, although they would have required very serious discussions for a range of their other difficulties. But it's too little and too late for them now. Thankfully, we don't need them. But we do need to act. The longer we wait before we act, the more victims we have and the more cost we have in our transition. So, times have changed. Has our story changed enough? A lot of what we think about when we talk about repentance is a kind of narrowing and straightening vision. Resist, refrain, reduce. For a long time, it was the only message that was work. They were the only tools we had. It's been difficult for the church, in some sense, because in the wider world, it plays into a stereotypical morality of a kind of wowserish reduction in the joy of life. We know better, but the world doesn't necessarily know this. Our real mission, our deeper mission, is as old as the church itself. Yes, we hold a mirror up to an imperfect world, but we show by our actions and our words that there's a better way. What does this mean practically? I think the most important implication is that amending our own life is not enough. We need to invite the world to that way. And the best way we can do that is to show our evident joy in it. The church has a glittering history of the evangelism of action. For individuals and for the church, this is showing people a better way is what we do. All this sounds a bit suspicious. I probably don't look like a televangelist, but it's sounding a bit like that. At the recent synod in Victoria and Tasmania, there was a motion on climate change. It was pretty good. It commended a lot of good things and condemned a lot of bad things and contained a lot of useful, practical action. But it missed the joyful, vigorous advocacy for the solutions that are now available to us. A trivial example. A couple I know wanted to celebrate the fact that their solar panels had just paid for themselves. They were fond of the good life, so they dedicated the next couple of power bills they weren't going to be paying to spend on a Queensland winter holiday. The way they described it was celebrating all the benefits that the sun could bring them. The church could do that. Not quite a Queensland holiday, but it's worth thinking about what mission and service is available to the church now as the green dividend starts to pay off. Let's extol the benefits now of protecting the future. I have a feeling this is slightly embarrassing for us. The church is a little bit embarrassed about saying when it's doing the right thing, but that's now what the world needs to hear. My last point of optimism is COVID. A year ago, the pandemic turned up and pushed fires out of the public mind, although I was corrected this week to say that that's very much an urban phenomenon. Country people see the lessons rather differently. I wept. I thought a hard lesson would be left unlearned. Instead, we learned two other lessons. One of them was a recovery of faith in our national institutions. I'm pretty sure that our chief health officers, people like Brendan Murphy and Brett Sutton and so on, didn't think of themselves as Moses banging on a rock with a rod to recall the people to an understanding of faith in their national institutions, nor did their political masters. But that's what they were doing. They were showing us that the institutions of society could be used to nourish and protect, as well as to divide and exclude. And we locked in behind them. We flattened the curve and we celebrated our ability to do it. And COVID did one other thing. The blueprint for recovery has shown us what we're prepared to do, how societies can bend their will to solve important problems. Various places are building back greener. The US, Europe, and Britain, I still find that hard to distinguish. And various states in Australia are dedicated to spending that COVID recovery stimulus on making sure that we come out of this stronger to face climate change. It's also given us a benchmark. We now know what we're prepared to spend to deal with serious problems that confront the society. As a useful comment on this benchmark, some numbers I saw recently show us that bringing Australia to net zero emissions by 2050, which is kind of the rough minimum that we think we need to do, is going to cost us about half a COVID. It's going to cost us about half what we're currently spending on stimulus to recover from the pandemic. So, does anyone else think that spending half a COVID to combat a 1,000-year threat is worth the money compared to spending twice as much on combating a very serious but 1-year threat? That sounds like a bargain to me. So the climate awakening didn't happen, but the climate journey has started. It's a journey with the people who are sometimes querulous and sometimes vibrant with a shared purpose. It's a journey under leadership, which is sometimes inspired, frequently insufferable. We have a vision of promise, but we sense mainly the wilderness. But now we've seen the road. We know where that road leads, and we know how to get there. What's more, we know how the journey can end. The story of our desert wanderers told us that. And so, with God's help, and with perhaps a new spring in our step, let's take up that journey again.